welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duva and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. At Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Good to see you, Neil. How are you doing
today? It's good to see you. Speaking of our sponsors, a couple of weeks ago we had Cornerstone Home Lending on, and they told us again about a program that really is unique, which is the ability to have a loan, not a loan approved, but a loan that is really without any contingencies, so you can buy a house by just stepping up and saying it's all cash.
Yeah, what did she call it? She called it the Home Buyer Advantage Program or something, right, which competing with all cash offers is, yeah, is a great great option, yeah, for those of us that don't have all the cash to put down.
It made me think about maybe buying another home.
Well, and it ties right into our guest today. We have Mr. John Fowler, who is the president and CEO for People's Self-Help Housing and the Duncan Group. Thanks for being here, John.
Thanks for having me.
But first, we'll do some articles, and this article is interesting. You'll be the judge of whether it's interesting.
Yeah, I'm like, let us be the judge of that, Neil.
It's from the Wall Street Journal. It says, consumer spending rise has dark side. And, you know, consumer spending has been one of the drivers in the really excellent economic environment we've been in the last year. But what this article highlights is that in the second quarter, you had a decline in the savings rate, and it is from 3.8% to 3.2%. At the same time, as you would expect, consumer credit outstanding has risen by $24.6 billion, which was double the amount that economists had expected during the second quarter. One of the things that we need to be cognizant of is that when you get into a situation where the savings rate goes lower and lower and people are stretched out, you have to consider the possibility that at some point the spending could be affected by either some blip in the economy, which is exactly what happened in 2008. So we were suffering not just from a housing crisis in 2008, but also from the fact that we had a zero savings rate, so there was no margin of safety.
Well, what's interesting about that, though, is that the savings rate since 2008 has crept up significantly. We used to have a negative savings rate in this country.
Right.
So the fact that we have anything is better than nothing.
Right. And it kept going up because people were afraid, but what this is saying is it indicated that people are becoming more willing to
more spendthrifty.
Now, this next article, which I think is really fascinating, and I think it's more rather than a business news story, it's really a think piece. But the article is about loss aversion. And what the article from the New York Times, Neil Irwin, who's a great writer, said that to understand the political risks of the Trump administration's starting a trade war, you need to understand a powerful human tendency, which is understanding loss aversion. People feel more pain losing something than they do gaining something. So, for example, if you lose $20, you feel more awful than if you won $20 and you were feeling great.
It's so true. And it's the same with the markets. People feel worse in down markets than the flip side. In up markets, they don't feel as good.
Right. So the article says, let's take that and look at trade agreements. And over the last three decades, industries that have lost ground, which includes aluminum and steel, tend to fight harder for protectionist actions than those industries that had gained from a robust international trade.
So wait, say that again. So companies that have lost ground due to tariffs or
no,
or such?
No, due to competition like from China. So the steel industry was willing to, not willing, was very aggressive in their outcry against Chinese cutting the price of steel. They were more motivated than people who went to Walmart to buy cheaper toasters, because the benefit of buying toasters didn't excite them as much as it stimulated the steel companies that were losers. So what this article is saying is that with today's beneficiaries now being some of the industries that were hurt, they may be less likely to be in a position of aggressively fighting for more tariff relief, as opposed to industries that are now being affected, and for people who are now being affected by the tariffs. So let's take a look at here's an example. And this is what's sort of ironic. There was a BMW worker in South Carolina, which, by the way, BMW is threatening to move out of South Carolina because of the tariffs, and it's the biggest employer now in that Greenville area. They asked this person in the BMW factory what they felt about international trade, and she said she was skeptical, even though the fact that she has a job is because of international trade, because her father lost his job in the cotton mill 30 years ago. So anyway, the winners and losers of a trade war can have can change how much motivation there is to fight. So what the article concludes is, look, you know, right now everyone was asleep at the wheel who were being hurt by these tariffs, and the few industries that have benefited, they're not going to be as aggressive anymore, and the whole thing could turn around where people are going to be more likely to complain than those that were where they were passive before.
Well, something tells me that if BMW moves their factory out of Greenville, South Carolina, and she loses her job, she will probably be more aggressively lobbying for it, right?
Yeah. So anyway, this was a think piece, and I could see when I was talking and losing everyone.
Yeah.
You were thinking.
You were talking, and I was thinking, "Woo, this is a good article."
And you were thinking, "What is he thinking?" Anyway, I think it's a good think piece, and you have to think about it. Tonight you'll think, "Wow, that was a good piece."
I think I'll probably think Neil is brilliant.
Brilliant piece. And this article from the Wall Street Journal is talking about, it's entitled The Surprise Party. And this is not really that big a surprise. It says that when companies outperform quarterly earnings, they tend to go up. But when they underperform quarterly earnings, they go down much more. And so what they found is since 2009, 70% of all companies have beat their consensus estimates. What the article opines is that and he calls it a tandem dance between analysts and companies. They tend to, he thinks, purposefully make sure that they've sort of underestimated earnings so that when there is a surprise, it's on the upside, because again, this is the sort of the same asymmetrical type of balance that we see with the last article, the last article, where, you know, being wrong on the upside is okay, being wrong on the downside is really bad.
So, does this author purport that there is collusion between the analysts and the companies?
Yes, the implication is, and I find this so, as a former securities analyst, and this is sort of the irony of it. In the 70s, if anyone called us a reporter, we were a guest. We weren't reporters, we were analysts. We didn't care what the company said necessarily. We did our own work. And now the expression that analysts use is company guidance. Now that in the 70s would have been an embarrassment to say the company is guiding me to do this. I wasn't interested in what the company said. You made your name by disagreeing with the company sometimes, saying, you know, I've done some primary research and I think that this is the right answer, not what they're saying. In today's environment, even if it's not collusion in the traditional sense of the word, most analysts today get their information from the companies, and so they are reporters. They're not analysts. And what I find also unfortunate is...
This feels a little like you walked uphill to school and home again in the snow, both directions, every day. Because, you know, from my understanding of analysts that I know, they're still doing...
Hands across the Wall Street.
They're still doing some serious technical analysis.
I should have had extra support. No, most of that, but analysts do are saying, you know, when the company reports bad earnings, analysts start to whine, the company was wrong. What about you? You know, all I can tell you is in my day, I feel like an old timer now. My day, you couldn't get away with saying the company was wrong. Where were you?
Right. Well, and I agree. I think that might be a larger issue of, you know, people having a hard time accepting fault at things.
Yeah. Once I was working with a law firm in a legal matter, and the pronoun the lawyer was using with us was we. And one day I got a telephone call, and he said, "You lost." You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
And if you have any questions for us, feel free to give us a call or an email at moneytalk@gmail.com. And we have in studio with us today John Fowler, who's the president and CEO for People's Self-Help Housing and the Duncan Group. Welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So first, tell us what People's Self-Help Housing and the Duncan Group, what it is, what do you do?
Yeah, so People's Self-Help Housing is a developer in essence. We develop homes, and we're a developer just like any other housing developer, except we do it for a different income bracket, so affordable housing, you know, sort of different AMI group, if you will. So, and we've been doing that for 48 years.
That's spoken like a true CPA that you are.
I am a CPA. I revealed that.
And what is the Duncan Group?
So the Duncan Group is our sister corporation. It's also a 501c3 nonprofit, and it does our property management. So some years ago, we started 48 years ago doing housing development, initially single family, home ownership, and then eventually getting into multifamily. When we started getting into that, we accumulated enough multifamily that we thought, hey, we need a property management division, and we thought it should be a separate corporation. So we created the Duncan Group.
Excellent. So now, given your background, so you went to California State University at Bakersfield. So are you a California local?
Yeah. So I graduated from Sacramento State. So I went to the junior college there in Bakersfield. But I was originally from Bakersfield, and for a number of years thought the whole world was like Bakersfield. So, you know, but I learned otherwise. But yeah, I'm a California boy.
You're California. And so what made you want to get involved in housing and especially the niche of affordable housing?
Yeah. So, you know, I've always been sort of community and mission oriented all my whole life. And so I started out doing all kinds of, you know, eventually becoming a CPA, I'll just say out of college and going to work for a CPA firm. And that was a number of years. And when I started to create a family, I said, wait a second, you know, I can't have a family necessarily and do these kind of hours.
Well, you can't have any life between January
exactly.
and April.
And then there were some other months that also popped up. And so eventually we had five kids. And so as you can imagine, there were some demands at home that I needed to do. So just because of the time frame, I eventually left the CPA firm and moved to the Central Coast and went to work for a construction company. And and they were starting that up, and I was in a CPA, and so I just over the years, you know, created that construction company. They turned out to be the largest construction company on the Central Coast. Eventually, we went through the recession of the late 80s, early 90s, and I jumped from there to a local bank and did all their REO property. And so it just ended up that I ended up with this deep knowledge and expertise in construction, housing, and, of course, the accounting background.
And so how much would you say that that background has helped you in your current role?
Oh, my gosh. I felt like everything led to my position that I have today. So, because eventually I left the free market world, if you will, and I went to work for the Diocese of Monterey, and I worked for the church for a number of years. And so I ended up doing, you know, their accounting for the church on school sites. Eventually, started because of my construction background. If you remember, there was a little earthquake in 2003. The bishop asked me, hey, there's this earthquake and one of our missions is damaged. And you know construction. Could you like get that fixed? So I ended up getting into mission. So I became the mission guy of California, really. I probably restored. So I restored San Miguel Mission, San Luis Obispo Mission. And I sort of traveled around the country, around the state, you know, giving advice about how other cities could restore their missions. And so so that was kind of a nice, but always in the nonprofit, trying to do something, raising money. So in this position, raising money, doing something for the community, community type. So it all resonated, CPA background, management, finance. It all just came together, and it really was perfect background for leading me to people's self-help housing.
Now that you say the Duncan Group is a 501(c).
Correct.
The people's self-help, is that not a 501(c)?
It is as well.
It isn't.
It is.
Oh, they're both.
Yes, they're both. Yeah.
Okay. And so can you explain the relationship then?
So when we started creating all these multifamily sites, which we now have 50 today, 50 different sites, you can say at some point we said, why are we outsourcing property management? We should do that in-house because we care about these residents probably more than anybody else does. So it became this continuum, if you will. We would develop it, kick it over to our development arm. They would manage the residents and the facilities, and we would go do development and kick it over. So it was this thing. At some point we go, we should all be one company. We follow this all the way through because on the property management side, they were telling us what the materials should be, what's durable for flooring, what works for all these things, what amenities do the residents need because of our wraparound services. So all of a sudden I said, as an organization, we all need to be involved in this development, including the property management, and we're all one big happy family. So we're consolidating those two organizations.
So when you build a house, you are building it for rental or for sale?
So we still do both, Neil. So we started out doing sweat equity only, self-help, home ownership, single family.
So give us the history on that. So that self-help home ownership.
Yeah. So there was a program created, way back in, the 60s, late 60s. And we were incorporated in 1970, shortly after that happened. About said, housing is an issue and in the country. And what are we going to do? So they created this program by which people, the government would provide assistance money, grant money for a nonprofit to go in and help people build their homes. They call it a technical assistance grant. So that basically covers a person sitting on a job site and saying, Neil, you've never built your house before. You don't need to worry about it because I have. And you would take about a year. And we started out acquiring the lot, selling it to the family, and then you would build that home yourself under our supervision.
So here we would be like Diane and Neil with the hammer on the roof, doing the roof. So it was truly the homeowner was building their home.
They're building their home.
So it wasn't a contract. They didn't hire a contractor. They actually had it. They built it.
They built it. We were their contractor. That's the subsidy agreement that we got from the government. It says, go out and help these people who've never built a home before because you're a construction guy. Go out to them and help them do that. So we would acquire the lot, do the subdivision, sell them the lot, and then we would get a construction loan through USDA. They would build their homes. At the end of the construction, we would convert that to a perm loan, and they would have a mortgage on that.
But just to be clear, because the word build a home can mean two different things, they actually had a hammer holster and were building it, or they hired someone to build the home?
They build it from the ground up. They dig the trenches for the foundation.
So they needed to be a certain kind of person, not just needing of financial help. They needed to be someone that could do this.
You know, anybody, really, I would say almost anybody can do this, Neil, because most of our home builders right now are single women. And you would think it didn't start out necessarily that way, but it's how we've evolved over the 48 years we've been around. So really, we tell people you don't need to know anything about housing. If you can dedicate 40 hours a week between you and your friends, 40 hours collectively over a year-ish, sometimes it takes them a little bit longer to build it, you can have your own family. I mean, your own single family residence. We will pre-qualify you, make sure you got the mortgage that'll fit you. We'll, you know, walk you through the whole process. At the end, we hand you the keys and you've built your own home.
And is there a restriction on sale? Once you
No, there's no restriction on sale.
Okay, so you are building equity that you get to keep.
They absolutely. And they almost all, you can imagine, on the Central Coast, they have equity the day they move in.
So as long as they have collectively 40 hours to be working at building this house, it works for them. With the construction loan, so you sell them the land and then they have a construction loan. Are they... I've got to imagine how to take out a loan for the land as well. So they have to have a stockpile of cash to make the payments on the land loan.
So we do all the buyer qualification. In other words, as soon as you tell me, hey, Neil and Diane want to build their home, we bring you in, we do the homeowner qualifications, we figure out what your income is. We say, yes, you know what, you actually qualify. Then we put the program together for them. All the financing is taken care of. We do all that.
So you do all the financing.
Yeah. So the construction loan will take out the land, and then, you know, just like a typical, you know, any other construction loan would do. And then at the end of construction, it converts to a perm loan.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back. Brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence. And right before the break, John, you said that you look at a potential homeowner's income, but they have to work 40 hours a week on the project. Does that mean they have to keep their full-time job?
That's exactly right, Neil, which is why you think this sorts, you know, how desperately do you want to get this into home ownership? Because you've got to work your full-time job, which qualifies for you for the loan, which you need to have, so you have to have the income. And then you have to put these 40 hours. And again, you know, it's a combination. If you and Diane were doing it, it would be 20 hours a week between the two of you. And if you can get your neighbors or somebody else, we try and get them volunteers. But collectively, you have to get a number of people to say, hey, I'm building my own home here and I need to get 40 hours. Would you, how good a friend are you? Are you going to help me for a year?
So are they like clocking in? Like,
absolutely.
How are you managing?
We're very tight about that. And again, after 48 years, we have it down. We know, you know, there are house rules about doing it. They have to show up and, you know, people get tired. You can believe that, you know, like, hey, that sounded
like
really good.
Off.
But you know what? 6 months into winter or something, you start to say, was this a good idea?
You know? So it's 40 hours for each homeowner.
Correct. Total.
So is there anyone else working there?
Absolutely. So we do these typically in groups of 10. So when they finish, they're all 10 families. It's like barn raising. They're working on each other's house. Hey, today we're going to work on Diane's house and we're all going to go roof. And tomorrow we're going to work on sheetrocking your house tomorrow. And all families work on your house. And we schedule it all out. And so that's why it's a commitment by the families. And once they finish, it's a ready-to-go neighborhood, right?
And there are people instructing them how to do a roof?
I mean, we have a site supervisor on every site, and he's always there, you know, whenever the families are there. Okay. And he makes sure, you know, hey, you know what? You just put that roofing on, but it's not quite right. We're going to need you to pull it off.
Okay, so this basically works when you have a piece of land that can facilitate 10 or 12 houses. You can't do this on a one-off basis.
It doesn't really work because you can't really spread the, you know, the supervisor. In order for the program to work, he's got to have a certain level. So we've done 4 and 5 lots before. It can be done. It's challenging. But we did one in Los Alamos. We had some remnant lots. So we did 5, and there were 3 and 2. So they weren't even in the same place. It works. We figure out how to make it all work. We track all the budgets, and then we do all the contract, all the bidding. We do all that pieces, all the paperwork for them.
So let's say in a particular community, a house would be worth at completion $250,000. what is the cost to the client, of your client, to buy that, to do it with sweat equity? Is it 128? Is it, 190? Is it 20,000? I mean, what's the spread for them?
Yeah, it's not that big, you would think. If we can get to that 80%, because land values on the Central Coast, as you imagine, when you talk about a 250 or something that people who are making 60% of area median income and less, what can they afford? They can't afford much more than, 300,000 is going to start to get to the top of their limit. So how do you get that value down if you're paying $100,000 for a lot? So by the time you do the lot and you do this, we've got it down to just, it's a pretty razor thin. But luckily, as we know, the market continues to move on the Central Coast. So we see that, while it might appraise today at 250, we know by the time they finish it a year later, it's going to appraise at 275 or higher, depending on what's happening in the market.
And are they like cookie cutter houses? Are they all the same, or do the homeowners have some customizable?
We'd love to have it cookie cutter because it's easier for our supervisors to do that. But we pick up like the last recession. Recessions, are good opportunities for us because for-profit developers, walk away from lots and we pick up lots, and so we're always in the inventory looking. It's like, oh, you know what? Those lots are kind of vacant and they're approved. Let's pick them up. So it might be a group of 10 or 15 remnant lots left over by a developer. We did that in Atascadero. There were 11 lots left that just a developer went under during the last recession, and we picked them up and made that work. So, but sometimes when you do that, they already have an approved house design, and that's a little harder for the families when it's a two-story and there's some gingerbread on that that's a little bit more than, so we want to have it something that is attractive that the home buyers can do, that we've done and we've built that plan before, so you sort of get all the kinks out of it. But it's not unusual for us, Diane, to pick up an existing tract that just hasn't been finished and finish it for the community.
So in that case, you could have some homes that are multi-story.
Yes, we do. Yeah, and we're not going to go three-story. Typically, it's two-story.
Right.
And again, you can't get too large with this because, these families are low-income. They have to qualify for that on an income basis, which means they're not going to, it's not going to be a tremendously big house. It's going to be 1,100, probably 11 to 1,400 square feet is kind of normal.
Which is fairly normal.
Absolutely.
For Santa Barbara area.
It's a great, not only starter home, it's a comfortable home.
So what are the income limits for qualification?
So it's going to be, they can't really go over, I would say, 80% of area median income. So, that's going to be somewhere in the 48,000 to 55,000, probably somewhere in there. I mean, they need to be able to support a mortgage.
Right? Of course.
And it's household income. It's not just, the head of household. It's the household income. So it could be the wife, and the husband, or and there could be even other kids, and there could be older kids in the home that help qualify. So, so it's household income that we're talking about.
So it's household income. And then primarily, where are these properties? Are they in more rural?
So it's interesting. The program has, evolved over the years since it started, and back in the late 60s.
Oh, of course.
And so now.
Well, it used to be rural.
And so
like
we follow everything in D.C. And D.C. is changing the rules in Washington and says, now, you know what? This is a rural program only available in rural America. And as you know, they're starting to define what rural means. Rural now means any jurisdiction that is over 50,000 is no longer rural. So the city of Santa Barbara can't have this program. City of San Luis Obispo, but it can happen in Los Alamos. It can happen in Carpinteria. It can happen in some of the smaller cities. So it's a population thing that's considered rural. So what we have is, our cities grow, the program becomes less and less available to us in our county.
And how much of an issue is it to get clients? Is there a waiting list, or is it you have to go out and find them?
It's a little bit of a combination because it's a big commitment, obviously, to give a year of your life and do it on top. So we initially get a great response, Neil, and you will get a nice list, but people won't qualify because of over income or whatever for the program. And so we'll sort through 100 people to find, 30. And then what happens is, once you go through that list, then we're now having people come every day on a wait. Do you have any home ownership? Yeah, we do. Actually, we're doing a project right now. So we try and stay ahead of it at that point. So we're continually taking names. But at this point, on the Central Coast, Neil, if you wanted and income qualified to build your own home in the right city, you should get a hold of us.
You don't want me building a house.
What happens if they don't finish it in the year? Like, what if it just starts slowing down?
They we haven't, we're pretty good about selecting and motivating, and you know, we've been doing this for a long time. So we don't, I can't remember the last time we had that problem, Diane, but it's conceivable and it could happen.
Right, because life happens.
And,
they could hurt themselves.
You know, that someone opts out of the program for whatever reason. And we would put another family in and probably continue that house and continue the program. So we have the ability to do that. But it's so rare. I can't even remember the last time that happened.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
And so we're talking, if you're just joining us, with John Fowler, who's the president and CEO of People's Help Self-Help Housing Group. And we've pretty much been talking about really you helping homeowners or helping potential homeowners get into their home with sweat equity. And we've defined, I think, sweat equity to mean they are actually out there on the roof, putting the roof on.
With a hammer.
With a hammer. Hopefully they have lots of friends because it will go by faster, I've got to imagine.
And as I say, we do try and help them with volunteers. Church groups will show up. University students will get together in service groups. And, you know, we tap into the community because we're here. And we tap into those services and say, hey, you know, let's go out and help Neil and Diane build their home.
So do people tend to do houses in the community they already live because they need to be near work?
That's exactly right. They're trying to get as close to their work as they can do that. And, you know, sometimes that's not possible because we don't have a program. So we're currently doing a project in San Miguel right now, but we just finished one in Atascadero, and they were like, we really wanted a project where our job is, which is Atascadero. We said, well, there's not lots available right now. Okay, well, we'll commute from San Miguel. Not a terrible commute, but...
So you have an office around the corner from the studio here in Santa Barbara. Who is that serving if we're not a rural community anymore?
So, you know, the majority of what we do now today is multifamily. And so we continue this program because it's part of our history. It's a program that's been around forever. It's a great program, but it's a small part of what we do today just because of, you know, fewer and fewer jurisdictions qualify for it, fewer and fewer families are able to do it, you know, that kind of thing. So it's one of those things we don't want to forget where we came from and our roots and create that opportunity, but it's more of a continuing a program. Okay.
So let's talk about that. What's the model now for multifamily? How does that work?
So multifamily is pretty much what they call a tax credit program. And so on the Central Coast, as you know, we have viewshed issues and all kinds of other things. We don't want to have too big a development. So typically we're not an urban area like Los Angeles or San Francisco. So typically a project will be 40-ish units. In fact, we just finished a project over here on Sausaputis and Haley. It's a 40-unit subdivision that we multifamily and dedicated that a little over a month ago.
And congratulations. So,
thank you. Yeah, it was a terrific project. It was an infill project. It was a vacant lot that was actually needed to clean up environmentally. The seller cleaned it up, sold it to us. But the program is basically, when you look at a project like that one here in Santa Barbara, it might cost us $15 million to build that project. Well, because it's low income and it's a rental project, the rents don't support a $15 million debt, as you can imagine. So what that means is you got to figure out how do you find some money to get that $15 million ticket taken care of. That's where the tax credits come in. So there's a tax credit program available, the state and federal tax credit that's administered by the state, and that's primarily how we build these multifamily sites now. A $15 million project, just to give you an idea, probably 11 of that will come from the state program that's administered. So we'll bring in federal and state tax credits and sell those on the open market. We get an investor, sell those tax credits, and they give us the $11 million. The other couple of million we get from either the city, home, CDBG, vouchers, maybe Section 8 vouchers will help. So we piece together the others and try and get that overall debt down to about, you know, $2,000 to $3,000. That the rents can then support a debt on that. So what we do with that is we go to the state and we say, hey, we got a project in the city of Santa Barbara. It's a 40 unit. It's going to meet, you know, certain AMI from 30 to 80% of AMI. we had the soft money loans from the community in the way of in lieu fees or CDBG or home, but we need the balance of this. We go to them. If it meets their criteria, they award what they call tax credits, and they give the project and say, hey, go build it. Here's $11 million of tax credits. We take those to the market like a commodity, and we sell them to the highest bidder. Hmm. And so we...
So where is there... Like, how do you do that?
So we're extremely good at this. So, in fact, we just did one, and we're in the throes of awarding this. I won't tell you who that contract's going to go to. But we go to the market, and we get... And it's the banks at this point are required to have CRA, Community Reinvestment Act is what it is. And they're required that if they come in and do business, remember the redlining that used to happen in Chicago, they said, listen, you're taking deposits from low-income people, but you're not servicing them. You're not providing loans. So they created the CRA Act, which says if you're going to go into community, you need to do something good for the community. And you need to demonstrate that while you're doing business, you do that. They have found that if they buy these tax credits, they can go to the comptroller's office in D.C. and say, we're great partners in the community. We're buying John's tax credits, and we're helping build affordable housing. What they do is they buy these tax credits, $11 million, and then they apply them to their tax, you know, basis, their tax.
Okay, but now with the tax reduction, the value of the tax credits is
going
down.
Good question. You're right all over it. So we went through a panic, as you remember, last year, because everybody was in D.C., and we heard Trump, and then we heard Paul Ryan, and we heard everybody saying, oh, it's going to be, this rate. It was going to be this rate. And we were like, and so all the market, as you know very well, they figure out, they guess what the market's going to be or what the tax rate's going to be. So initially, all the investors left the market. Let's see if Congress is going to define what the true tax rate. So we were in deals trying to, sell these tax credits. Investors pulled to the market, says, let's wait and see what happens. And so we finally got some people to step up, and we were able to move those projects through. But you're absolutely right. It's based on what is that tax rate and what are those credits worth to us? Mm-hmm. And so it overall killed the market, I would say overall, Neil, about 20%. So where we were getting a dollar tax credit, we could sell for more than a dollar in the market because of who we are and our projects and everything. We were getting $1.13, $1.15, $1.18, which is phenomenal to build a project. All of a sudden, now today we're seeing in the 95 cents per tax credit.
Next year, this time, you'll probably be in
the market, and we're selling these to the high, and we're leveraging. But it's bank who's buying these credits, and it's all the big boys. So it'll be J.P. Morgan, it'll be Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase. I mean, it's
but they're selling it to their clients. They're not keeping it. The banks can't use the tax credits, I don't think. I mean, I think aren't they just basically a middleman?
Yeah, so we use a syndicator, obviously, and they bring them, and the banks also pick up the construction. So, there's multiple reasons. They need the CRA credit to show they're doing good things. Yeah. They do need the construction loans, which are usually tied to that, and they do need the tax credits, whether they're using them personally, I can't tell you, or they're doing something else with them. But
in order to get the CRA credit, though, they have to use them personally.
I would think so, yeah.
I don't think that they can reissue them.
Right. It's a great market. They make money at investing in our projects. So and they get CRA credit, and guess what? We get a project. So it's a partnership of public and private, and that's why Congress, both sides of the aisle, love this program because they see it's not governments going in and providing this. These banks are creating.
So how do you differ from the Housing Authority?
Yeah, so the Housing Authority is a quasi-public agency. They're,
right.
You're typically tied to a city or a county, what have you, and they're they pretty much report to HUD, because that's the HUD department. Where we will do rural, which would be USDA, and they're going to be somewhat tied. They're going to be somewhat tied in what they do on a regulatory basis because they're kind of publicly, politically and restrained, if you will.
Right.
We're not. We're a nonprofit. We can do whatever we choose to do, and we'll go in, and we see ourselves as a community development company. So what we would typically see, we're trying to do something in the city of Guadalupe. As you know, there's some, it really needs businesses. We've lost a lot of this trying to convert, and you wouldn't see the Housing Authority go in and say, hey, how can we bring businesses to the city of Guadalupe? How can we, create investment or do mentoring? So we will do community development. We'll provide more rapid wraparound services will, we raise money, we do donations and everything. Housing authorities typically don't because they're more quasi-governmental
agencies.
So it's a little bit different, although we both build affordable housing and we partner together. The city of Santa Barbara has a great housing authority. We love working with them.
So you keep these multifamily houses, you keep the ownership of them.
Forever.
And is there any thought of starting to peel them off till you have more money to do more, or you don't want to do that?
We never do that because really the reason why I get out of bed and the reason we do this is because of the mission part of it. My background, as you know, is construction and finance and all that. But what gets me out of bed is the fact that we're taking care of people and we're housing them. And so it's the wraparound services, it's the after-school programs, it's the seniors that we're helping to get to their doctors. I mean, it's the services that we're providing and the community benefits that we're doing. That's...
Well, you're lucky because what gets me out of bed is my three dogs kicking me in the morning. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm. Founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And so, John, as we're having this conversation, it strikes me as, Santa Barbara and low-income housing, we provide a lot of low-income housing for the lowest of income. But given the cost that the amount of money it takes to live here, really, it's the low-income housing is necessary. But are there any services for that middle income bracket? So they're making over $100,000, but they still need help.
All right. Great question. And this is where we pivoted 2 years ago to workforce housing.
That was the term I was looking for.
For 46 years, we did affordable housing and low income. And then we said, that's our wheelhouse. That's what we do. But we saw that there was a market and we said, listen, there's another group of people. It's affordable housing. It's just a different AMI group, which is the workforce housing. And we said, we don't see the market solving that. We don't see a developer coming in unless he says, hey, listen, I'm going to deliver something that's very small, so it's under marketly priced. But then it immediately gets pulled to the market and is not affordable then. Mm-hmm. So I said, let's go out and see if we can't provide a product to the market that's called workforce housing that serves 80% of AMI up to 160% of AMI, assuming anyone over that could take care of themselves. But this is the group that we wanted to do. So we acquired a piece of property. We wanted to do it here in the city of Santa Barbara. We were in negotiations, but we fell out of that. So we ended up getting a piece of property in San Luis Obispo. We said, so we acquired it 2 years ago. We bought it at market value. We have to pay market value for all the subs and everything. We designed something that we said, listen, there's no government subsidy. There's no soft money for this. It has to be the employers. Let's do a collaboration with employers and have them provide the equity by which we make this thing pencil. And so we've gone on 2 years of trying to figure out how to do that. We've worked with our attorneys who talked, So we are now in communications with six, almost seven employers in San Luis Obispo that I just made presentations and said, we are ready to go. We have a 40-unit subdivision, turnkey. If you're going to be a partner on this, I'm ready to break ground tomorrow. It's already approved. And all I need for you to do is provide equity in those units, and those units become available to your employees. The employees will buy these units. It's a condo project. Mm-hmm. They'll have home ownership. And when the employee leaves the employer's employment, the house is triggered to turn over and goes back to the employer, who will assign another employee, and we go through this cycle. So it's perpetually workforce housing for that AMI group. It's funded with a partnership with employers, and we're now about to find out if those employers are going to step up and write a check and say, you know what, I need employee housing because I can't recruit, because I have retention issues. Mm-hmm. You've got a development. I know you're going to do it because you've been around for 48 years. You're a professional builder. We take all the mystery out of it, just like we did on the self-help for people who've never built their homes.
And how much of your operations are funded by the donations versus return on these houses, on these multifamily houses?
So the majority of what we do gets funded through the development. We're development arm, Neil. So we get, and the government limits what we can do. They give us a 14% profit on each development that we do. So the project that we built in Santa Barbara, 14%. I don't care what it is, 14%. And then they say, listen, if you go to the market and you get those tax credits and your construction goes over, you just eat up your 14%. In other words, we can't have the market solve our problem, so we have to be very, very good at this. So majority of our bottom line, and I would say our budget is, you know, $11, $12 million a year. Most of that comes from development. About maybe $500,000 of that, Neil, comes from donations.
So that's pretty good leverage then.
It's a great leverage. And we also do our own in-house construction. You get that 14% on construction as well. Half of that falls to our bottom line because we're a great builder. And so we're making money doing development, and then we plow that back into our supportive services and our after-school program.
Well, you know, in Santa Barbara, a big issue during the last mayoral election was the fact that we don't have workplace housing in Santa Barbara, and it's really too bad you're not here. Maybe Goleta.
Yeah, as an employer, I think hopefully the city of Santa Barbara and Goleta will look to San Luis Obispo as a model. Hopefully, yeah, this all works out for you. We wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, thank you so much for all you do. Thank you for being here. You've all been listening to Money Talk, and we'll see you next week.